Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. In fact, that book, The Finality of Jesus Christ, is not a long book, but it's a very important book, and if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage. Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mention those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel. We've come to 1 Samuel chapter 6. In our last study, we saw how God had punished the Philistines for their sacrilege against His holy name, and how He had demonstrated His superiority to the demonic power that the Philistines worshipped under the name of Dagon. Behind every idol stands a demon. Paul tells us that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. After the Philistines had seized in battle the sacred Ark of the Lord as a trophy of war, they had placed it in a submissive position before their idol god, Dagon. They had done this in one of their temples in the city of Ashdod, and their doing so implied the superiority of Dagon to Yahweh, the God of Israel. To their way of thinking, the God of Israel had seemed helpless in battle to defeat them, worshippers of Dagon. Therefore, their God was superior. At this point, the God of Israel, having voiced His displeasure with His people and with His priest by exposing them to a humiliating military disaster, the Lord moves to reclaim His name in the eyes of the Philistines. No matter how badly we smear the name of the Lord, God is always in charge of His own name and always knows how to reclaim its glory. And here He does so. The Philistines had wildly misconstrued the meaning of Israel's defeat when they had taken the Ark of the Covenant into battle as a kind of charm. And they had misconstrued Yahweh's willingness to allow that Ark, which symbolized His invisible presence among His people, to be captured by them. So this first divine act of reclamation of his glory in the eyes of his enemies was a symbolic miracle. On two consecutive days, we saw in the previous chapter, with successively emphatic force, the Lord had caused the image of Dagon to topple from its place in the temple before the Ark of God in prostrate positions suggestive of Dagon's nothingness and powerlessness before the one true God, Yahweh, the God of Israel. Now we come in chapter 6 of 1 Samuel to the second divine response to their sacrilege and their irreverence and their contemptuous treatment of that holy object, the Ark of the Covenant, which symbolically represented him. It stood for him. And therefore, the Lord caused an outbreak of a horrible plague precipitated, as we know from this chapter, by an infestation of disease-bearing mice. Everywhere the Ark was moved, the plague followed. So chapter 6 in 1 Samuel moves us forward in time 7 months. During this period, when the Ark of God had been hostage in Philistine territory, life had become just a sequential horror for the Philistine people. The Lord is reclaiming his name. When they had celebrated the Ark of the Covenant, which they identified with Israel's God, when they had mistreated it as a trophy of war, now they lamented it as a curse of death, as we're about to see. In a divine demonstration, intentionally, I remind you, reminiscent of the awful plagues the Lord had inflicted upon Pharaoh and Egypt generations before, but by no means forgotten by the Philistines, you can be sure, God sent this scourge of mice and the subsequent plague of tumors, which was threatening to wipe them out. Now, the Ark of the Lord had been in the country of the Philistines for 7 months, and the Philistines called for the priest and the diviner, saying, "What on earth are we going to do with this Ark of the Lord? Tell us how we shall send it to its place. We've got to get it out of here." Well, they said, "If you send away the Ark of the Lord of Israel, for goodness sakes, don't send it away empty, but you shall surely return to him a guilt offering. Then you shall be healed, and it shall be known to you why his hand is not removed from you." Apparently, the Philistines couldn't all agree on whether or not there was any causal relationship between the captive Ark of God or some accidental circumstance. So they started moving the Ark from town to town, and everywhere it went, it came with the same lethal effect. We saw in chapter 5, it went first to Ashdod, then Gath, then finally Ekron. The panic spread, and it was intensified. Hard as it was for them to accept the religious significance of these plague events, the correlation between the events was getting harder and harder to ignore. How could it be that the God of Israel, who seemed just recently to be so inferior to them in battle, so inferior to their god Dagon, because in these situations it was not only the nation that was superior, but the nation was superior because their God was superior. That was their logic. And the God of Israel had earlier seemed unable, to their way of thinking, to defend his own worshipers. They got the wrong message entirely, and he had allowed them to be slaughtered wholesale. So how could he suddenly and so belatedly rise up against the Philistines with such ferocity? So badly did they want to believe the plague and the captured Ark of God were unconnected events that, as we saw in chapter 5, they were willing to make guinea pigs of their sister cities, moving it around from town to town. Their denial of the God of Israel, not his existence, but his power, was so great among them that their neighbors were even willing to go along with the experiment for a bit. In the end, however, as the plague followed the Ark from Philistine city-state to city-state, it was harder and harder for their ruling class not to reach the conclusion that the God of Israel, for whatever reasons he didn't stand up for the army of Israel in battle, this God was now speaking up for himself and holding them accountable for insulting his glory and trashing his great name in kidnapping and desecrating the Ark, which symbolically represented his presence among them. And let every modern take notice. That God has not changed. He may let his name get trashed for reasons that he understands, and in this case we understand, but he will not forever be taken lightly. He may be scorned, he may be mocked, he may be ridiculed, men may shake their fist at him, and God may do nothing. But in the end, God will do something. And when he does something, he will shake the foundations. And so he does here. The pagan Philistines realized at last that the Ark of God was a sacred object just too hot to handle. They had, in effect, bitten off in their evil boldness more than they could chew. What started out as a victory tour, moving the Ark from town to town, had been now downgraded to a death march, and people were dropping like dead leaves on a breezy fall day after the first hard frost. So we meet here in chapter 6 with a high-level deliberation. So the headline topic in the Philistine CNN and in the National Security Council was, what on earth are we going to do with the Ark of Yahweh, the God of Israel, in order to placate him, to pacify him somehow, and arrest this deadly plague? The diplomatic question in high places was, we have to rid ourselves of the presence of the Ark, so how do we go about restoring it to its proper place among the Israelites without offending this awesome God even more, and bring down even worse indignation upon ourselves? They were beginning to get the picture. So they did what most of us do when we're in over our heads and need some help in some area. They called in their experts. How modern. In this case, their experts were their pagan priests and diviners. The priests were that religious class whose office it was to mediate for them with their supposed gods in preventive and corrective maintenance. Through appropriate sacrifices and offerings, these priests kept those gods happy or appeased them when they were cranky. The diviners practiced divination. Divination is the supposed art of discovering the will of the gods. Of course, it's really consultation with demons. It's really the art discovering the will of the gods, of forecasting the future from indications ascribed to those gods or those spirits, and of deciding from phenomena supposedly supernatural the correct course of action to be followed. So in essence, their question was, how do you spell relief? Well, they get a recommendation in verses 5 through 9 from their religious experts. They were told that they ought to present a guilt offering. And they asked, what shall be, verse 4, the guilt offering which we shall return to them? And they said, 5 golden hemorrhoids, or tumors, 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. For one plague was upon all of you and upon all your lords. So you shall make likenesses, images, of your hemorrhoids or tumors, and likenesses of your mice, because that was the cause, the tumors were the effect, the mice that ravaged the land, and you shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will ease his hand from you, your gods and your land. So why then do you harden your hearts? And here they remember the Egyptian experience generations earlier. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptian and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? The Lord had caused that message, as he said, to be broadcast throughout the whole Mediterranean world. When he had severely dealt with them, that is the Egyptians, did they not allow the people to go, and they departed? Now therefore, take and prepare a new cart and 2 milch cows upon which there has never been a yoke, and hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves home away from them. Take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart. Put the articles of gold which you return to him as a guilt offering in a box by its side. Then send it away that it may go. And watch. If it goes up by way of its own territory to Beth Shemesh, that was an Israelite town, then he, Yahweh, has done us this great evil. We'll know there's a cause and effect relationship. But if not, then we know that it was not by his hand that struck us. It happened by chance. We'll know there is no cause and effect relationship, and we're making the wrong assumptions. As dark as their minds were spiritually, and as dull as their consciences were morally, the Philistines were now more ready to concede that Yahweh, the God of Israel, the God they remembered as the one who decimated the Egyptian empire with his awful judgments back in the era of Moses, was indeed, they were conceding, an awesome God and not one to be messed with, not one to be treated with disdain. And that message God will eventually and ultimately get across to the whole world. This is just a cameo of what will be the ultimate issuance of human history. They were beginning, though reluctantly, to reach the conclusion that they, by their wrong treatment of him, had brought down heavy-duty trouble upon themselves, which could only be relieved, they surmised, by some kind of restitution. If they were right about the cause of the plague, they know that they must send the captive ark back to its proper place. They must get it back to the homeland, Israel. Their question was how to accomplish that without aggravating the first offense. So they consult with their experts. By various forms of the usual pagan hocus-pocus and contrivances, and you can be sure that the providence of our sovereign God had something to do with their conclusions, it can be assumed they reached the conclusion that they dare not send the ark back naked, so to speak. They recommended that it ought to be accompanied with a guilt offering. That was just a kind of religious apology to the offended deity, in this case, Yahweh. So what they come up with is a self-concocted guilt offering or human apology that seemed good in their own eyes. Yahweh should, they think, be pleased with this, if, that is, there really had been a true cause-effect relationship rather than a coincidental one between the plague and their pain and death. There's still some ambivalence about that, as we see in the text. They are still in some denial. If this, then that. But if that, then this. So the experts were very scientific about all of this. They planned to test their hypothesis. So here's what they did. They commissioned craftsmen to fashion 5 gold objects, representing 5 lords, 5 city-states, fashion 5 gold objects in the likeness of the afflicting tumors, and also fabricate 5 golden mice, 1 to represent each of the governors of the Philistine Pentapolis, 5 cities. These golden replicas, indicative of the effects and causes of their plague, as I mentioned, should accompany the ark on its return to its homeland and would, they surmised, also constitute an acceptable repentance for the wrongs they had done our God's great majesty. Hopefully, this would be sufficient to persuade Yahweh to ease his hand upon them, the Philistines. That was their experts' recommendation. It is fairly clear how strong the denial was in some quarters. Apparently, the proposal was not an easy sell. We can see that because the priest and the diviners had to weigh in with a heavy reminder that if this was in fact the hand of God, look, people, we're not dealing with a God you can jerk around. So they tell them, do you need any reminding? Let us give you a history lesson, they were saying. So if they need a little history lesson, remind yourselves of what this God did to Egypt and Pharaoh when they hardened their hearts against him. So to any of the stubborn doubters among the Philistines, they said, be warned. Otherwise, it may be, as Yogi Berra said, deja vu all over again. This is not a God to tamper with. So take heed. To resolve any lingering doubts about the source of this plague, they set up an experiment to settle the issue. As I say, they were very scientific in their practice. The plan was to build a brand new ox cart into which they would place the Ark of God, but not naked. Along with it, they were to put a box or a chest containing their guilt offering, representing their apology to Yahweh, the deity they had offended. Hitched to this cart, they prescribed 2 fresh cows, which had never before experienced the yoke. They were to pen up their calves at home and send the cow-drawn ark off in the direction of Beth Shemesh, just over on the Israel side of the border. That was the nearest Israelite border town, and it was one of the cities, significantly enough, assigned by Joshua for a settlement by the Levites, the priestly tribe. The prescription of a new cart and the requirement for cows never before yoked was symbolically appropriate. Even these pagans understood that you don't honor deity with cheap stuff. You break out your best. You don't send the Ark of God back in a cart from rhetoric. And the same goes for the pulling cows. Even the Philistines understood what a lot of professing Christians don't seem to get, who never mind to keep their shoes on holy ground. The theory was that if there was nothing supernatural about this plague, but if it just happened to be a convergence of chance circumstances, then they reasoned the cows hitched to the ark would do for cows the natural thing, try to follow their calves. Maternal instinct would take them in that direction. On the other hand, if the kind went against their nature and they headed straight out in the opposite direction from their calves toward Beth Shemesh, and if they did not wander or divert aimlessly off the way, but they made a beeline, a straight course, for the Israelite town of Beth Shemesh, then there was no reasonable doubt that this thing, as they conjectured, was from the hand of the God of the Hebrews, Yahweh. So they implemented the plan, and the cows drew the cart straight for Beth Shemesh, contrary to nature, counterintuitively. The men did so. They took the cows, hitched them to the cart, shut up their calves at home. They put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the likeness of their hemorrhoids. Verses 10 and 11, verse 12. The cows took the straight way in the direction of Beth Shemesh, and they went along the highway, lowing as they went. They didn't turn aside to the right or the left. And the lords of the Philistines followed them to the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh, they were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. They raised their eyes. They saw the ark. They were glad to see it. And the ark came into the field of Joshua, the Beth Shemite, and stood there where there was a large stone. That was providential. And they split the wood of the ark and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took the ark of the Lord and the box that was in it, in which were the articles of gold, and they put them on a large stone, and the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices that day to the Lord. When the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned to Ekron, one of the five cities of the Philistines. They returned that day. Then in verse 17, it's mentioned that the golden hemorrhoids, which the Philistines returned for a guilt offering to the Lord, was one for each of those five cities, and the golden mice, and so forth. Well, in God's providence, it happened to be wheat harvest. The time was mid-April to mid-June, so a lot of the townsfolk were, by God's plan, out in the fields to witness the joyous spectacle of the ark returning unattended from the Philistines, drawn by two cows, driven, no doubt, by the invisible hand of God. As you can well imagine, the ark was immediately surrounded by Levites who resided there in great numbers. And in honor of this most sacred object, they promptly set about doing the religiously proper things. They lifted the Ark of the Covenant from the Philistine ark and made appropriate sacrifices in honor of God's symbolic presence, for the ark was not an idol, it just symbolically represented God's presence among them. They used the wood of the wagon and the cows who pulled the ark for sacrificial purposes. But there is yet a most important sequel to observe. For all their religious, now here we're talking about the Israelites, for all their religious hoopla and celebration over the return of the ark, the text emphasizes that their joy soon turned to sorrow and fear when a great number of the townsfolk were struck down by the indignant hand of God. Keep in mind, these were days when men did that which was right in their own eyes. So we read in verse 19 that the Lord struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh. Here's why. It was their presumption and disrespect for the holy, even though they'd shown some respect. They showed that they did not get the holiness of God when they did the following. They had looked into the ark of the Lord. That was an absolute no-no. He struck down all the people, 50,070 human beings, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. Well, that put the fear of God into them, let me tell you. And the men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord? Ah, get this holy God. To whom shall he go up from us?" There is a quasi-identification of the Ark of God with Yahweh himself. The Philistines have brought back the Ark of the Lord, and they were saying, "This thing is too hot to handle. Come down and take it up for you." Well, friends, we'll look next time at some of the powerful lessons that can be adduced from this narrative. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.